This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Patreon tipsters Emily O, Jules, Amanda R, Aaron, Margo, Francesca, and Anne B. Thank you so much, guys. You can get extra content like after-show discussions and bonus book reviews by joining the tipster team at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now on with our show.
These are six human beings who are children of God like anyone else, who deserve to have their situation taken seriously by everyone.
Showtime is staking out some prestige true crime territory with its first documentary series in the genre, Murder in the Bayou. And, to mangle an old proverb, when hedge fund titans fight, it is the downline that suffers in Herbalife/Wall Street documentary Betting on Zero. It's a nutrition club for your brain. The Blotter Presents, Episode 12. And those shakes are working so well that I can't even get the podcast name out on the first try. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that tries to find the true crime that's worth your time. I am thrilled that today's first-time guest thinks the pod's worth her time. You may remember her from the Freddie Gray arc on Undisclosed. Please welcome Dr. Marcia Chatlin. Hello.
Hello, Sarah. I'm so excited. How are you?
Are you? That's wonderful. I am also very excited.
True crime is where I live. I was an unsupervised child, and I watched all of this stuff really young, and I actually think it's a genre worth discussing.
I agree. Let's begin. Since Showtime finally agrees that it could be eating part of HBO's lunch, they're elbowing their way into the genre worth discussing in our most wanted section. Murder in the Bayou. Here's the case file from Wikipedia about the case. The Jeff Davis 8, sometimes called the Jennings 8, refers to a series of unsolved murders in Jefferson Davis Parish, Louisiana. Between 2005 and 2009, the bodies of eight women, all of whom had an involvement with drugs or prostitution, were found in swamps and canals surrounding Jennings, Louisiana. Most of the bodies were found in such a state of decomposition as to make the actual cause of death difficult to determine. Author and investigative reporter Ethan Brown has revealed how police investigations have been plagued by missteps in the sheriff's office, contributing to lost or missing evidence. Brown's work has also revealed that there are multiple suspects in the Jeff Davis 8 case, and that therefore it is unlikely that this is a serial killer case. Furthermore, Brown has revealed that law enforcement's own witnesses have named members of local law enforcement as suspects in the case, end quote. We got two screeners for this, and that's all Marcia and I have watched. Two more screeners were made available, but we didn't get to those. It's five parts in total. It premiered last Friday, and I believe it follows Brown's book fairly closely, although I have not read it. Brown does appear in the series. We haven't gotten to some of the accusations in that second part of the Wikipedia entry yet. So let's start with some overall thoughts. Marcia, how did you find the first two episodes of Murder in the Bayou?
Unlike most of these types of shows, I didn't know about this case, which was kind of surprising to me. My only association with Jennings, Louisiana, was a story from a few years ago where a justice of the peace refused to marry an interracial couple. So all of that is to say that...
Good start, Jennings.
I really was impressed by the fact that there was this weird way that it kind of mirrored the slowness, right? Like the slowness of the way that people talked and the kind of slowness of the story. There was a way that it kind of worked because it took its time, and I guess by having so many, having so many episodes that it felt like it didn't have to overwhelm the viewer. But I think one of the ways that people often critique this type of thing is that it doesn't focus on victims. And I felt like victims were really at the center of the first two episodes.
I agree. I liked that people were allowed to talk how they talk, and there weren't a lot of those like stupid Dateline tricks of people kind of, there was a little of that. Like there was a little bit of the fetishizing of smoking cigarettes as a shorthand for working class.
Yes.
Or, you know, struggling with addictions, that was like, you know, we get it. Like we can hear the cherry of the cigarette going down. Hannah Connor said, like, okay, we get it. She smokes. There was a lot of drone work that, you know, is fine. But I wish that people would pull back on that now, knowing that we all think that's a documentarian tick.
Yeah, I feel like it reached its absolute worst when it was done a lot in that Michael Jackson Leaving Neverland, and it was not necessary. The content was more than enough for the audience.
Oh, yeah. That was a strange thing. And it was like seldom drones flying over actual Neverland either. It was just over a courthouse. Okay.
Not necessary. We like, get it.
Yes. We agree that this is a courthouse. Well done, sir. I did enjoy also that I think that sometimes when there is a aspect of the story that the story and the people telling the story make explicit of like literally a wrong side of the tracks axis along which the story is being told, that sometimes there can be a little bit of like hand holding there, or there was a little bit of, you know, driving past the big mansions on the right side of town in Jennings. But sometimes that comes with a condescension to the subjects that I didn't feel was present here. Did you agree with that?
I did. I mean, I think the opening narration, there was a little bit of that classic true crime, you know, she just lit up a room and I, you know, she was so amazing. But what I liked is they kind of like cut the bullshit really fast and said, look, these people were very complicated. And the women who were victims here had a lot going on, but we also have a lot going on. I think that there was this kind of acknowledgement of just how much addiction is wrapping itself around everyone on the quote-unquote wrong side of the tracks.
Yeah.
And I kind of appreciate that, because I think sometimes in the like Datelines, that kind of storytelling makes the person's addiction or, you know, some of the kind of illegal things that they're engaged in, like the shocker, like, oh, it's so surprising that the person, you know, did this. But in this case, they're saying like, this is how people survive. This is how people live. And I think the subjects were transparent in a way that they didn't use this documentary to do their image management. And I think that that's a very normal impulse for people to have when they get to retell the narrative.
I agree. That's a good way to put it. I liked that there was that transparency, but also that when you're dealing with a more tabloidy network property, there is this moralization of drug use, drug addiction, and some of the ancillary, quote, crimes around that, that it makes it a moral or criminal or ethical question. And this documentary made it a fiscal survival question and wasn't trying to cast anyone as good or bad. It was just the reality of life in this part of town.
I also think when they do the thing where they show like the fancy part of town and the not so fancy part of town, this reminds me, I used to live in Oklahoma. I used to teach at the University of Oklahoma, and it was really interesting. These economies built in these kind of smallish towns around regional medical centers or the oil industry, that there's these places in America that have these really stark class divides that I think rarely get represented in any kind of television form, that you can have these communities where there are these really highly paid, highly skilled specialists, and they kind of create their own upper class kind of suburban life in these small towns where people are in crisis and they're living below the poverty line. And I think that Jennings, as a place that these people are super vulnerable to all of these forces, is an interesting story in and of itself. But the class dynamics that I don't think a lot of people think about in these smaller rural places is really interesting to me. And I think that in setting that up, I think they also set up this idea that people in Jennings who are on the wrong side of the tracks, they're on their own. They got to figure this out for themselves, because there is a more powerful community that will get the services and the response that they need.
Yeah. Well, and also it is motivated in order to protect whatever, their community, which can mean everything from the value of their real estate to their children to whatever, that they are motivated to keep what's happening on the, quote, wrong side of town, on the wrong side of town, and wall themselves off further, figuratively and possibly literally. You called for our first clip. Do you want to talk about why you asked for this sequence?
Sure. You know what I just realized? It's Hammond, Louisiana, where this racism happened, not Jennings, even though I'm sure racism happens at Jennings. I would hate to besmirch Jennings any further by suggesting that a justice of the peace. Okay, go ahead and play the clip, and then I will talk about the clip afterward.
All right.
Whatever she did out here, she didn't bring to my house, because she was there spending time with her kids. And when she left there, she did whatever she did.
She might have did her drugs and this and that, but everybody got some kind of weakness, you know, and that was hers.
A couple days before she went missing, Loretta asked me to walk to the bar with her. She looked at the bar. It looked like she noticed something. She looked back at me. She gave me her purse. She don't ever give me her purse. She gave me her purse and told me to put her purse at the top of my mom's closet just in case if anything happens. And that's the last time I seen her, because she turned me around and made me go home.
One day, Loretta came to the door and she said, "Roxanne, I'm tired of living this life. I want to raise my children. I'm so tired of this life." She said, "I'm gonna leave and I'm not coming back." 3 days later, she was dead.
So I asked you to isolate this clip because there are two things that are happening here and I don't know what to make of them. One is, some of it feels very movie-like. This idea that these are death for, you know, this is a death foretold and people are right, preparing for this. And I always wonder, not even just the veracity of it, but the context. Is this something that the women who were, you know, what they say in this life, and there's all these euphemisms, you know, doing what she did and she didn't do this. Is this just the way that people communicated with each other even before the killings? I'm just very curious if the killings had a chilling effect, or if this is just a reflection of the precarity of living, you know, beholden to your addiction. And so there are these moments that I do wonder if the filmmaker is like, oh, this is really great stuff. And how much of it is a reflection of the paranoia that sets in when you are addicted, or the fear that is part of, you know, exchanging sex for drugs in the context that they were doing it. And there are these moments in the documentary that I don't know what to make of. I don't know. What did you think?
Well, in that sequence, I was struck by, first of all, the first person that you hear speaking is someone who looked after this woman's children, and you definitely get the sense in this larger sequence that there was a found family among these women and among these victims that was functional. perhaps not ideal or predictable, but it was functional. I was also struck by the way that, you know, we'll sort of backdate an event to find our impressions of the day beforehand, having just passed the anniversary of 9/11.
Yes.
I think that was absolutely a natural instinct for a lot of people and remains that way. And now this is part of the testimony that we give about that event. And I think that that's a natural human response to any trauma, whether it's losing a friend to murder, whether it's, you know, 9/11. But I also felt that some of this was like, I don't know exactly how to put this, but I felt like they were speaking sort of a dialect of euphemism that they expected us to get.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That we might not have been, that we might not have caught up with at this point. This is like 7 minutes into the first episode, so.
Right. There's a lot of people doing stuff. There's business. There's all of these things. And the problem, I think, with it is you don't know the extent of it until a little bit later. You know, because I think someone says, you know, first it started with some alcohol and some weed, and then I was smoking crack with my dad. And you're like, oh, wait a second. You know, like, this is actually pretty serious. And so I think this actually leads to the second clip that I pulled that is also very interesting in the framing, if you'd like to play that.
Sure. Here we go. Clip three.
Jennings is just your typical small town. A lot of the families here are second, third, fourth generation. They a lot of hardworking people. Just good old country folks, mostly. A lot of farmers, ranchers that grow rice, soybeans, raise cattle. Everybody over here is related to somebody. That's how usually they start off a conversation, is trying to identify what family you're related to or married into.
People like to live in the area because it's away from a lot of the hustle and bustle of a bigger city. Here it's a little quieter, a little slower pace, and people tend to enjoy that.
Any town has, you know, there are issues. We have a lot of issues with burglaries and thefts.
So I wanted to pull that clip because I think this goes into the economy of euphemisms here. This is a movie about, like, the murder of several people. And there's a way that they open up the explanation of the town is like, this is like Mayberry. Everyone here is family. People live here because they want a quieter pace of life.
Yes, get away from, you know, urban problems.
Exactly.
Oh,
like, this
really?
Isn't New Orleans
or,
or Baton Rouge. Oh, but people steal a lot of stuff because there's a lot of drugs. And as a result, this type of stuff happens. And I think this is the kind of narrative dependency system of, like, the real America, the Trump's America, a quieter place, but, oh, by the way, it's gripped with this really terrifying way of life. And so I think that in having the townspeople frame their town themselves in this way, I think the filmmaker is, you know, kind of nudging us to say, huh, that's an interesting way of people describing a place as different than problems elsewhere, but it's actually pretty consistent in the ways that people feel really scared all the time.
Yeah, and they're definitely trying to sort of reframe those problems as different when they aren't. There is a part, I think, a little bit after this where someone says in so many words that you do have problems with people robbing to get money for drugs. Like, at least someone finally hangs a little light on what is actually happening. But that this is like, well, you know, burglaries and thefts, like, well, they're not taking the cattle. are they?
Right, exactly. Well, and then there's also this idea when they talk about this one gentleman who may be associated with these crimes, about, you know, who's big time in the drug trade. It's a really interesting question as to what big time means in this context, but this is a person who seems to have a lot of power and a lot of influence and is a known, you know, quantity in terms of the drug problem in this town.
Yeah, and certainly a convenient scapegoat. Frankie Richard, we meet fairly early on in the series, and at the point that you and I are at and watching it, I'm not going to conclude anything about his involvement in these murders. He is fairly, first of all, he looks a little bit like Keith Richards.
So absolutely.
I'm glad that wasn't just me.
No,
and
absolutely.
Is one of those, a lot of, like you get out of the Northeast and like the nature of towns is just different because towns aren't like shoulder to shoulder in the middle of the country. And you have there's always that one guy in the town who's like 5'7", 120. He looks like a piece of gristle with a mustache, and he can kill you with his non-dominant hand while eating a sandwich. Frankie Richard.
Vanity Fair. Sir Bundy, that's your next profile. I mean, talk about an illustrative and accurate description. And, I mean, he scared the hell out of me when he came onto the frame. I was like, oh, surely this guy has murdered someone, if not these people, in the way that they framed him in the story.
Like, the way they lit him.
Jeez Louise.
Like, everything is just like this ominous dark brown. And I would not be surprised if he suggested, it's like, make me look like a badass. Like, oh, you don't need any help. But
and they have like the one file footage photo of him from like 82. And then something has gone wrong the past like 37 years because he's so creepy. But here's the thing. Like, this is prestige, but is it? Because when you light a person in that way and you have them kind of in the frame in that way, is this a cheap trick?
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder that too.
And it works, though.
That goes with when they're talking to Hannah Connor, her uncle, Frankie's her uncle, / godfather, / Dutch uncle. There are some braided-in relationships.
Yes, there's relations.
But he... Like, I think this is someone who is perfectly content to let people think that he killed someone. But he's also very open about the fact that he was progressing to worse and worse drugs that were requiring him to eat less and less, which would explain why he's like a rubber band with shoes on. And he's also, like, he's pretty direct about what he did do.
Right. And so, that he had, like, no need to murder these women because essentially he was trafficking them. So his logic is like, well, why would I do that? And then he kind of comes off as pretty convincing after he says that,
yeah,
you know, that this is not his kind of thing. But one of the kind of big questions that, you know, kind of undergirds episode 1 and 2 is this a serial killer or is this just kind of the nature of the behavior of folks who are in this, you know, underground economy of things that just happens, and it happens to be near a bayou. So it's this real kind of weird common sense of all the disorder that's happening.
Yeah, exactly. And there's also the fact that there is, I think, well, I'll play clip 4, but let's say that there is perhaps a higher tolerance among this community for behavior and associations that this extreme WASP found suspect. Here's clip 4.
He was always my safe spot. You know, I was a daddy's girl. He was always a safe place for me to go. And I believe that a lot of these girls that went to his house felt the same way too, you know. I know many of the girls were in and out of his camper, partying, you know, come and hang out, getting free drugs, because that's what the camper was known for. If you were a woman, you can go sit in my dad's camper and get all the free drugs you wanted. Just come and go as you please. Hang out in my dad's camper and Frankie'd be around. Frankie is my uncle and my godfather. Uncle Frankie was like the guy you didn't mess with.
There's just so much going on there. Hannah Connor, she's talking about her father, and in this same part of the episode, she also mentions that he had been, you know, in a relationship with one of the victims who was a friend of hers and her age, and she was fine with it or thought it was sort of funny. And, you know, get all the free drugs you want. Like, well, I'm sure they're free the first time.
And nothing is free.
Everything has its price, especially for these people. And I believe it wasn't her father, but someone else's father was interviewed and was not currently in the penitentiary, but had been often. And I think there's just sort of a revolving door in this part of this town to the penitentiary for robberies, for drug possession, for, you know, God knows what all. And it's not possible for them to get off it, even if they wanted to, which they may not. So I thought that clip was a good encapsulation of what this sex and drug economy is in this part of this town. And also that the series is not judgmental about that.
The series isn't judgmental, but I do wonder if part of the strategy of opening up with the victim's friends saying things like, you know, we all went through hard times, but when she was with her kids and she wanted me to make sure her kids were okay. And then you get Hannah Connor revealing a little bit more about one of the victims in this kind of disturbing way, that I think the filmmakers have a little bit of kind of self-control and self-awareness of what does it mean to give us that information as late as they gave us. Because once I heard that, I was like, I'm sorry, what? When she's like, oh yeah, I came by the trailer, my friend's naked with my dad. And I was like, oh, okay. So
yeah, and there's this like tee-hee to it that's like, oh my God.
You know, and so I think that there's so much of this that could have just been really done for titillation and shock value, and yet it is still quite shocking. And I think about, you know, if Showtime is trying to put itself in relationship to what HBO and what Netflix is doing. Did Showtime also do the I Love You? No,
that was HBO.
That was HBO. Okay.
Showtime has done some true crime documentaries, but nothing. They haven't done a series until now.
So this is interesting. So I wonder then what is analogous to this type of series on kind of the other big series. I guess maybe the Adnan Syed one, but that one is, I think, a more high-profile case. I'm just trying to think about where the blueprint for this type of series comes from. And
it wasn't a series, but the HBO documentary from, I think, 5 years ago now, Tales of the Grim Sleeper, did come to mind when
yes.
I was watching this, because it was, you know, this was a case that I had not heard of. The, you know, sort of stated, the thesis statement of the documentary is that most people haven't heard of it because it was sex workers of color mostly mm-hmm. who were getting killed. And the filmmaker sort of talking to victims' families, to victims' friends, and just letting them talk and come to their stories at the pace that they needed to feel like they weren't going to be judged by the, you know, the eye of the camera. It felt similar to this, but it's in a series. I'm not sure we have an analog.
Well, one of the things that's also kind of interesting about the first two episodes, it shows how the story goes from something happened in town to something happened in town again to journalists are looking at this. And I think that might be a good setup for the clip that you put out about journalists and people who are skeptical of the police narrative and what happens to them, to the point where it is on CNN and people are talking about it in, you know, from the New York Times article and from, you know, a larger scale reporting about kind of how much time passes before this becomes a bigger story. And in that process, there's so much time for, you know, police ineptitude, if not misconduct. There's so much time for stories to get distorted, for people to remember different things about the past. And so I think that this is also a story like the one about the Grim Sleeper, about which victims matter and what happens when too much time is accumulating before there's really clear scrutiny.
And maybe it's also a story about the nature of this kind of story. Like, once it does get to the national level where you have a Times article, you have CNN coverage of it, that is going to decomplexify it because it's for a wider audience. So I think that the complicated sort of social dynamics that are in play in both the crimes and the investigation of the crimes may get sort of worn smooth when you get, you know, when you have to sort of distill it down to a 180-second segment on MSNBC's headliners or whatever, that it's like, well, this is now an issue of linkage blindness with a serial killer, or this is an issue of small town constabulary in over their heads. Like, well, maybe it's either of those things or both of those things, but it's not only one thing,
right,
in my opinion. Let me play the next clip where the sheriff
this guy
decides to sort of give certain readers and citizens in town an excuse to think that this is not really their problem in clip 5.
This article comes out in the Jennings Daily News. Enrique Edwards made a statement saying that these girls were living a high-risk lifestyle and that this lifestyle contributed to their deaths. As a matter of fact, he said, if you're in this lifestyle, it's time to get out. And at the time when the term high-risk lifestyle comes out, there's all of these connotations that suddenly spring to mind, especially the idea that these women have chosen this sort of lifestyle. The connotation is that they chose for this to happen.
You know, I tried to take Kristen off the street several times, but drugs controlled this little girl.
Ricky Edwards telling the news that it's their lifestyles, prostitution. Well, yeah, let's just say that. That way the upper scale people, don't, you know, can look at you and say, oh, well, it's their fault.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to come near you, because if you can say that the victims chose this, then you're safe.
Well, not just in choosing that, then no one else has any other kind of responsibility. I mean, I think if this is about, you know, what poverty can look like in America, what an incredible, you know, view or lens into it, where people are not destitute all the time and people aren't on drugs all the time, right? That there's all of these mixed experiences, and these women got caught at the wrong time in a life cycle that could have included a lot of different experiences of who they were and their community.
Yeah. And there's the idea that I think persists among the more conservative of our politicians, that poverty and addiction are choices. Like, yes, choices are made in there, but like, who, like, it's, you know, lifestyle. No, that's not how we talk about this, because who would continue to choose that after a while? And even if they did, I'm put in mind of the fact that the presidency of the United States, which is also a choice, comes with a ton of security from the United States Secret Service, because nobody is looking at the president and being like, well, he chose this, so if he gets shot, tough shit. Like,
well, absolutely.
Why?
And also, just this, the whole sheriff's department charade that happens here, that once they're under scrutiny, they're like, oh my gosh, we have so many officers working on the case, and if anyone had a problem with one of our officers, we would just have someone from the next parish investigating. I mean, everyone has such a sophisticated answer of the protocols and like the rules and what you're supposed to be doing, and none of it applies to how these victims are treated in their, when they were living and when they were dead. And so it starts to become kind of like a comedy of errors, a comedy of manners, that everyone is talking about all these policies and these task force on this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, guys.
I was going to mention that next. That it's like, what's the expression? If you need something done right away, do it yourself. If you have a little time, ask for help. And if you have forever, form a committee. Like,
yeah.
The formation of the task force and then just the immediate divide between the numbers that were supposed to be assigned to it and the people who are actually working on it.
Well, I think this actually is a good tee up for the clip that I picked, the clip 7.
Absolutely.
Me and my friend, we went out trying to capture this serial killer that we thought was on the loose. We rode the dark roads, we rode the back roads, and we went down all lanes in Jeff Davis Parish, man, from one end to the other, in my truck. And we had 2 .45s, I had a 9mm, and a shotgun. And we loaded up with ammo, and we went out there, brother. Who would have ever thought, man, that it was about to happen to us?
I had to watch that twice because I thought he did this after his step granddaughter like went missing or was or her body was found.
Yeah.
He did this before. He was on it.
I didn't realize it until you called for the clip times, and I was pulling the clip and I was like, oh shit, this happened before.
And I think that this is actually a part that I would have loved to learn more about, because when an entire community is engrossed by fear around something like this, people do stuff like this. And depending on your perspective, it's a perfectly sound response or it makes zero sense to do it. But I think this idea that, people decided that they were going to protect themselves and their community just speaks volumes about how vulnerable so many people felt. And I think for him, knowing that this member of his family was involved in drugs or sex work, or may have had friends that could have brought her into something that included violence, like, he decides that it's up to him. And this idea of him and his friends just doing this, I would like an entire episode about how people try to protect themselves. One of the victims who was a teenager, and it seemed a little different than the other murders. The mom says, I didn't really want her to leave the house. I said, you can go to the dollar store. And then she doesn't come back. And I think that this is the stuff of living under this that I wish this documentary talked a little bit more, because I think that this is also an active part of the experience of what is it like when you are rearranging yourself around this new set of fears.
That you absolutely can't and won't and aren't counting on law enforcement to back you up. You'll have to do it yourself. That it's striking to me that the way this is narrated by the step-grandfather is Not that he's unserious about it, but he talks about it in a matter-of-fact way that suggests that he's like, well, the raccoons kept getting into the trash. So right. We built this thing, and then we sprayed a bunch of peanut butter on the side, and then we wired these volts. Like, the matter-of-factness that he would have to patrol, and then he's describing the firepower specifically that he chose for this task. The matter-of-factness is very striking, particularly, as you said, that it happened before, because law enforcement has its own idea of what happened, and it will go to some lengths to get various square pegs into the round hole of Frankie Richard is a shit bird. He must have done it. So here's clip six.
I made up a story so the Jennings detectives would leave me alone. These people led me to what they wanted me to say. Like, I really didn't know where Kristen was dumped. You know, they led me to where her body was found. And then I recognized it from the TV. They led me to what they wanted me to say, and I just wanted to be left alone.
What do you think's happening to these girls?
I have no idea.
What do you think should be done to figure it out?
That Jennings, that they need to get on their J-O-B. Jennings police needs to handle their business. They should have never let it go this far.
Well, there it is.
There's the detective work. And can I just tell you, like, I'm the one relief I have that this happened in the 2000s and not the late 90s is there weren't a group of teenagers a la Memphis 3, West Memphis 3, that they could right. say were doing, you know, satanic cult stuff. I mean, like, this is so perfect. Also, the fact that the victims were both white and black, so this didn't turn into something where they, like, round up every black man in town and accuse him of murder. I mean, that's the only self-restraint that I can applaud this police force for. And at the same time, I'm incredibly curious about how this happens in such a small town in this way. And I think one of the ways that you can see the impact of this type of documentary filmmaking and this type of journalism is that the people who are on the short end of the protection stick have a language to talk about the police not living up to their end of the bargain. There's this weird thing that happens if you watch enough of this stuff where you turn into a character in it. And I'm wondering if there was a real self-conscious understanding of how people attack the police as a result of having decades of this type of storytelling, that they know how to talk to journalists about police failure. They know how to raise this issue of this false confession because they've seen it in other places.
Yeah, I was thinking about that earlier today, that it's like now that these are recognizable narrative strands that are often woven into this kind of material, is that something that subjects in this material will instinctively pull and then help you weave into your narrative about it? Because there has been not only sort of a lifetime for them of accrued ignorance on the part of the police, apathy on the part of the police at best at times, but also a lifetime of ingesting, even sort of accidentally, true crime materials and understanding, like, okay, in order to get the audience's attention, one of these menu items must be present. I don't think they're that cynical about it, but I certainly am, so...
Oh, absolutely. And you can see it in the juxtaposition between the local reporter and the national reporter. I can't remember the two men's names, but the guy who's kind of close to the story in Louisiana yeah. and the New York Times reporter, it's an interesting juxtaposition when they talk about this story.
Yeah. And not least because the local reporter was basically told by Sheriff Ricky Edwards that he got victims killed by publicizing the fact that there was reward money available for information about previous victims. This poor man was nearly in tears relaying the story. This series is really something. I'm definitely going to keep watching because I like the way it's built. I like that it's not, it doesn't feel by numbers. There have been some hints dropped that more than a few people think law enforcement is directly involved and not merely incompetent. And I'm curious to see, because, you know, I had to spoil myself and go on Wikipedia, and it's like, well, same. Shit's not solved yet. So that's not what this is about, I don't think. I think what this series is really about is still, in these United States, a certain kind of victim is still less than, and that, you know, that's a, both creates ripples and is a ripple in a struggle. So yeah, I think this is good. I think it's well done. Are you going to keep going?
Absolutely. I am just so curious about on what note they have to leave this as an unsolved
yeah.
crime. I'm always curious how they kind of, how they tie it up. And then, you know, as it's being aired, it's also impacting the way that people are talking and thinking about the case in real time. So I'm always curious about the stories that emerge.
Yeah, that loop is always interesting, particularly if it's a weekly series, as I believe this is, that what is going to be happening in the, spaces between the bricks of this building while it's being built for us. So once again, I know not everyone gets Showtime, but you should consider the free trial. Like, wait till they've all aired, get the free trial, binge it. I think this is good. I think it's worth your time. Moving on then to a slightly lighter-hearted artifact in the cold case section. We're talking about Betting on Zero, which is a 2016 film about Herbalife, sort of. Marcia picked this one out, but I'm going to read the case file and then ask her why she wanted to talk about this one. Quote from the film's website, so buckle up. It's about to get gold in here. From Darfur Now writer-director Ted Braun comes a riveting docu-thriller following controversial hedge fund titan Bill Ackman as he puts $1 billion on the line in his crusade to expose Herbalife as the largest pyramid scheme in history. Herbalife claims Ackman is simply a market manipulator out to make a fortune from short-selling their stock, but Ackman insists Herbalife deliberately targets low-income and immigrant communities and robs them of their life savings. Herbalife is joined on the counterattack by longtime Ackman nemesis and fellow Wall Street billionaire Carl Icahn, while Ackman finds an unlikely ally in Chicago activist Julie Contreras, who rallies the Latino community to get the federal government to intervene. Blending tales of high-stakes corporate intrigue with working-class people caught in the crossfire, Braun paints a stirring picture of the American dream gone wrong. End quote. First of all, we'll be the judges of that. Second of all, has anyone ever just described, like, regular old garden variety corporate intrigue? It's always high stakes.
And it always involves working class people caught in the crossfire.
I know.
Rarely is it, like, corporate intrigue that helps the working person.
Or actually fairly boring, badly paced corporate intrigue that's pro-worker. Like, that's never going to be a thing. You could cut some of these adjectives. What made you want to take a look at this one?
I am obsessed with scams, particularly multi-level marketing. Wait, which I guess is legally not a scam. I'm obsessed with pyramid schemes because I always think about, I write about black capitalism and all of these things that people thought about in the 70s particularly that was supposed to be a good idea. And the way that you do this historically is you tie it to something that is just so noble or so earnest that people just want all the way in. And I'm always curious about manipulation. Like, I'm always curious, like, if I wanted to start a scam, who do I trust to come in? Like, how do you ask someone to scam with you? I'm always curious about, like, aren't you in trouble? They're going to tell on you, or they're going to be like, whoa, that's a scam. I don't want to do it. And so I think that these pyramid schemes are fascinating to me because it has that kind of intimate ask of, like, can you come scam with me? But on a large scale, and it's super public, but it also requires manipulation behind closed doors. And so whether it's leggings or candles or makeup or, you know, storage, I'm trying to use no proper company names, storage items.
I was
items.
Just going to come out and accuse Scientology by name.
So Sarah did that. I didn't. But, you know, it's what human need is being fulfilled by creating community around selling a product instead of, like, talking to each other or, you know, eliciting feelings of needing to revolt against corporate intrigue. I love stories of this. And it's always so fascinating how this is done, and it's perfectly legal, but it's so not legal.
Yeah. And it's legal, but it's not ethical. This is a matter for the movie Election, I guess.
Yes.
The first clip from this section goes right to what you were saying about trading on ideas and dreams of a certain kind of future. And this is explained in clip 8.
Herbalife has done a great job reaching into the Hispanic market. The lower income immigrants have these hopes to find a successful life here, to set up a small business. Herbalife says, yeah, and here's how you're going to do it.
Yeah. And that's pretty much it. And the way that they phrase these things and their own argo for what they're doing is keyed into this idea of, like, you can work for yourself, you can have this luxurious lifestyle. It's like the, you know, the 4-hour work week does this. I mean, I don't know Tim Ferriss, and I don't know if his, I haven't read it, I don't know if it's bullshit, but there is this like love of the shortcut that exists in all human beings, I think, that they're also trading on. And but this documentary also raises, although it I wouldn't say comments enough on the possibility that it's also not ethical what Ackman is doing, which is basically taking a short position and then trying to get the government to investigate this company and back him up. He says to drive the company out of business, which I would have no problem with, but also to,
but oh, by the way,
yeah, but also to bail him out of a gigantic short position, which I felt like the documentary needed Ackman and needed that to be the narrative, that Herbalife is bad and Ackman is sort of an alloyed good. So it wasn't necessarily questioning whether this was a great, you know, whether this was, like, morally defensible as a way to bring Herbalife to justice. Did you feel the same way, or did you think it was us what we needed to know?
I was really mixed. I watch a lot of CNBC American Greed, and
same.
This reminded me of, like, a less tongue-in-cheek, like, American Greed with a little gravitas, because it's talking about the kind of inner workings of these Wall Street types. And I guess part of my question is, like, if something like Herbalife is allowed to exist without regulation, why is Ackman allowed to exist without regulation?
That's, and it's, yeah,
it's
exactly
this kind it. Of, it's the kind of Howard Schultz, Tom Steyer, it's these kind of left of right center types who want to be the good guys.
But they also believe that pure capitalism can exist and not cause harm.
Absolutely. So, like, they think it's wrong that you shouldn't manipulate people or shouldn't pressure them into these schemes. But do workers all need health care? I don't know. I mean, these are the types of guys who go head to head with Elizabeth Warren on stuff, right? Because they believe that there's a kind of corporate benevolence that makes up for responsibility or accountability. So if he sinks Herbalife and then happens to make all this money, we're supposed to be focused on the sinking of Herbalife, which makes me wonder if the documentary filmmakers needed access to the story, so they had to put Ackman in the frame, because I do think the story of Julie Contreras, how she became an activist, and the things that she's trying to do in her community, I feel like, for me as a viewer, that would have been the type of documentary I could still be plugged into. I also felt they had
other opportunities in various Talking Head interviews that they got, like that Zach guy, who was like, all right, well, you get the feeling he still sort of buys into the Herbalife plan, but
the guy in Oklahoma,
he converted all of his Nutrition Club storefronts into vaping parlors, so he managed not to lose everything. Like, jeez. Oh, buddy, I'm not.
He's probably not
sure about that. I wish you luck. That car is very cool. Glad you didn't lose it to the bank. But there's also that attorney that the Herbalife class action class gets, and he's standing in this like little Marriott ballroom after he's briefed them, and they all put hands on him and pray. And the look on his face is like, I don't know what this is, but I don't hate it. So he might have been a better in to talk about this, but Ackman is better than most Wall Street guys at explaining what he's doing, at least. Like, I know what short selling is, but I'm goddamned if I could tell anybody else how it works. Here's Ackman.
Short selling. Imagine for a moment that a friend of yours collects rare coins, and you have the view that those coins are going to go down in value. So the way you would short those coins is you call up your friend and say, can I borrow a few of your coins? And he says, sure. And you borrow the coins. You then sell them for the $1,000 each that they sell for in the market at the time. And then you wait for them to drop in value. And you turned out to be right, and the coins dropped in value to $500. You go back into the market. You buy them back for $500. You've sold them for $1,000. You've repurchased them for $500. You've made $500 on each coin. And then you return the coins to your friend. Your friend is in the same place he was when he started, and he has the same coins that he started with. You might have to actually pay him something for borrowing the coins, because he loaned them to you. So you might pay him an interest rate. So he's happy because he's made interest lending you the coins. You've made money profiting from the decline in the value of the coins, and that's short selling. That's when it works.
Can I tell you, like, this is like when Mitt Romney was running for president and he would talk about someone being good at sport, and everyone's like, what are you talking about? Just this kind of, just the example, like, let's say you have a friend who collects rare coins. What? Who are you talking about?
They're always rare coins. I didn't notice that this is always the example, but since my father, a Bond guy for what it's worth, but also a rare coin collector, this was always the example that he used, but I just thought that was because he collected rare coins. But this is such a Wall Street-y way. Like, let's say that you have the view. No one ever thinks anything or believes anything. They're taking a posture, or they have the view. I mean, he's so Wall Street-y that I kind of want him to be on a treadmill and smoking like Michael Douglas in Wall Street.
I mean, he's got the, like, silver fox. The whole thing is so ridiculous. And he's in this town car, and he's like, you know, this is going to be great. And he just has so many PowerPoints. Like, is the other thing that I always, you know,
Bad spacing. You ever notice that?
The aesthetics are so bad. And I think about my students, you know, like, who I teach at Georgetown. So many of them go into, like, Wall Street or consulting. And, you know, after a year, there's like, Professor Challen, all I do is make PowerPoints. There's so many slides, and he's trying to convince all of these people that Herbalife is evil, but because they're like Wall Street types, they don't have like their cousin or their best friend who's constantly trying to sell them powdered milkshakes. But like, this is where like real Americans could really be an asset. Everyone who is of a certain class has a friend who's trying to sell them something and get them induced into an MLM. But like, these people are like, so tell me more. You sell it, you eat it. What is this thing?
Yeah.
It's so bad.
It really. Yeah, it's true. Like, you always do have that, like, relative who's, like, trying to get you to go to Toastmasters, or, like, try these shakes, or, like, you make your own earrings at home. You're like, oh, my God, I can't. Like, I want you to be happy, but I just can't.
When I lived in Oklahoma, I had no friends. I just moved there. And, you know, people are like, hey, do you want to come to a party at my house? There's a presentation. Oh, no. And I just assumed.
Like, I don't need Tupperware.
You know, and I grew up, like, you know, with churchy people. I was like, okay, it's a Bible thing, but I, you know, I'll go there. I want to make friends. But it's even far more offensive than that. It's like scented candles. Oh. And part of it, it's interesting with Herbalife, because I think Herbalife is not one of the highly feminized one, because there's a strong gendered component of how MLLs, MLMs, you know, exploded as a way for middle class moms to get their own money and to have their own thing to do. But there's a way that this model has kind of spun out into something that's supposed to secure the American dream. And so it's an interesting way that this marketplace has shifted to the changing realities of where people are so desperate to earn money, but not just desperate to earn money, desperate to feel like they can govern themselves and their time and their movements. And it's so mean the way that they entrap people, especially the undocumented community, to feel like they have no recourse after they've bought all of this, like, I don't know. I don't even know what it is. It used to be just vitamins, but apparently it's like Soylent or something. And you can just eat. You could just drink these milkshakes and never have to eat again. It's just so upsetting.
I will also say that there's like B-roll of the shakes that is occasionally used to underline an emotional point. And sometimes it's just this like...
So gross.
Grotty, clotty, green... clumps clinging to the side of the blender, and then one of them is like plip into the surface, and you're like, I got it.
Did
it's
you
gross.
Know about the Herbalife clubs before? I didn't know about that before this documentary.
Well, that's such a strange thing too, that they're going to look for them in Queens, and it's like, well, this is where this is supposed to be, but they're not allowed to use the name.
What
of
is
the corporation?
I don't even understand why Herbalife needs to further ruin people's lives besides like filling the garage with this like crap by having them have leases. That part was so confused. It still wasn't clear what the motivation was, but I do think that the whatever kind of real estate scam is involved in leasing out the clubs, I do wonder if it enriches people at the very top of what do they call it, the downline, the top line.
Yeah,
scam line, whatever.
Line, the scam line. The tip line. Yeah, I think this documentary was pretty good at explaining what, like, how a pyramid scheme works. I think it was a little shakier on distinguishing very firmly between a pyramid scheme and, like, an MLM that stays on technically the right side of the statutes in terms of the legality. So here's clip 10.
The way an illegal pyramid scheme works, success is based almost exclusively on the ability to keep recruiting others. A new recruit comes in towards the bottom of that pyramid, and at any time if we stop the recruitment process, we find that those people at those lower levels have no way to earn income. The probability of success declines as the number of people join, and we can prove mathematically that 95% of these people literally have to lose their money.
Multi-level marketing presents this as normal business competition.
I hear that, and it makes sense to me. Like, I understand that there is a difference. Like, I think a pure pyramid scheme is mostly like currency or money flowing up, and then more money comes in to cover bets made on the initial money. Like, okay, fine.
Right.
That's made off. That's not legal. I understand what that is. I also understand what an MLM is, but I would have liked more, if they want to use the cute little graphics from The Profit or whatever, to just explain to me, like, how... like, what exactly is it that lets Herbalife turn to DOJ or whoever and say, you know, that's not what's happening here? Is it a physical product? Is it that they can say that they're selling, like, I don't know, some kind of Anthony Robbins motivational situation where they're like, it's actually a meditative product. I just don't understand exactly what keeps Herbalife on the right side of the statute. And I also don't quite understand why it wasn't made more explicit that what Ackman is doing may feel satisfying because the film wants us to think Herbalife is unethical and immoral, which I do. But what he's doing by trying to involve the FBI in driving the stock price down is not angelic either. And could someone talk about that? And the last third of the film felt to me rather slow because we were kind of revisiting the same statements of purpose over and over again, and there hadn't been any movement. So I would have liked a little more time on those explainers. I don't know how you felt.
So from my understanding of nothing and watching American Greed,
look, you have American Greed set to record. I think you're an expert.
I thought that the way that companies like Herbalife protect itself is that they suggest that they don't compel their people to purchase the product for personal consumption, that all of the inventory is purchased wholesale for the selling to others, and that the no-no is actually, you know, you covering your Herbalife minimums out of your own pocket because you want to stay in the system.
Okay.
And so that makes no sense, right? Because there's no way of regulating that. But I feel like this is
right.
The kind
Although,
of tipping
I mean,
point.
That's like a tissue-thin rationale, but if that's the rationale.
I think that this is, I literally think this is how they describe it. And so if you are, and then they say that you aren't making money by recruiting more people, you can be in a supervisory relationship with the other people, let's say in a tier below you, and the people below them, and that you're getting commission from their sales, which is not a pyramid scheme, but sounds like one.
What it sounds like is the mafia.
Ooh.
But I mean, that shit, at least the foot soldiers get paid.
I mean, well, that's or get some protection. I mean, not saying that we're endorsing any of these ways, but
no,
all, you know,
certainly not. But look, let's look at systems that have functioned and report that they functioned. That's all we're doing.
That's all we're doing. Well, here's the thing also that I thought could have been a better documentary is the corporate board of Herbalife, where they have, like, you know, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright talking about how this is a solution to food insecurity and obesity. And you're like, wait, what? And after this documentary came out, she was not happy. And she started, you know, asking all these questions. And I think she felt very compelled to distance herself from Herbalife. But I think that this could have been also a wonderful meditation on corporate boards and how people gain access. And, you know, we don't have to look that far from Theranos to see how people are peddling their influence for these products that, you know, have no vetting. And I'm curious
and
about
that. They're certainly not vetting, that they're like, my job is to have a name and get the check.
Absolutely. And so all, I think the connections, I think the thing about this movie, it felt like three really good long form articles in three different publications.
Yeah.
You know, one would be the thing about the kind of Herbalife and this community organizing would have been great in Mother Jones. The financial stuff would have been great for the New York Times Magazine, and The Atlantic could have done a wonderful story about the board members. But you put them all together in the same film and it just I liked it, but I felt like it could have done some clearer things.
Yeah, I agree. We have one last clip. Do you want to do you want to prepare people for this individual that we're about to hear from?
I mean,
without
it's like
the visual, it's a little different.
It's just it's everything you could have. Someone who is like down for this.
Yeah.
Visualize the most down for this person, and also like the way that it kind of reminds me of like Tammy Faye Baker in a way, not so much in the makeup, but in the kind of enthusiasm for something that is dependent on a lot of people in deep need. Let me just say that.
And this like bulletproof commitment to being cheery in the story that is just not going to be deflected by anything. I'll play the clip and then I'll comment.
Right as soon as somebody comes into our club, we say, "Welcome to the club!" And that's a little something that we welcome into the club, and you know, they feel the high energy that's in there. There's music going. You want to watch out how much you tell them about, you know, the business, because you'll be like, "Oh, they're just looking to recruit me," or "They're just looking for, you know, to get me into their business." So you really want to start building relationships with these people first.
On that very first day, it's all part of planting the seeds. You don't need the whole tree yet. That'll come in time. Trust me, but be patient. Do the deal.
The deal is here. What we're doing inside the club, it's about building Herbalife. It's about duplicating. It's about growing our royalty. And if we're just there, just, you know, slinging a bunch of shakes and, yes, having a lot of fun and doing that. But the thing is that we're there to duplicate, to grow our check.
This woman has got zero time for the actual product. Which is like nothing against the shakes. But anyway, recruitment. It's like, okay. Okay, let's ease them in and let's sell to them by being that one cool Herbalife person who isn't selling to them.
I mean, all of this makes
me psychologically fascinating to me. I could have listened to refugees from the lifestyle all day.
Absolutely.
It's just fascinating to me. And I think it is a scam, but I think it's also a scam that people want to believe in and don't feel quite as bad about getting taken by. And maybe that's why they still have some traction in American life. But I'm fascinated by it. This was good, but if you get like an hour and 10 minutes in, you're probably set.
Yeah. Definitely. And, you know, American Greed, I'm sure, has done this one. So if you need the Cliffs notes.
Absolutely. All right. So that is, once again, Betting on Zero, which I kept thinking was called Getting to Zero when I was Googling it. I'm like, no, that's not. That's not what we're talking about at all. It is available for streaming on Netflix, and there will be a link in the show notes. Marcia, where else can listeners find you / what are you working on right now?
Well, listeners can hear me every other week on the Slate podcast, The Waves, where we talk about gender and feminism and politics and pop culture. And I have a forthcoming book called Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America, which is coming out in January with LiveRight.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being here. I really hope you will come back. This has been as delightful as I dreamed.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, we'll be talking about Unbelievable. We'll be talking about the new Motive podcast. And further down the line, we'll be talking about Robert Chambers. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on Facebook, Twitter, and the Gram. And at Eve's and my true crime review newsletter, Best Evidence. That's bestevidence.fyi. 2,000 paid subscribers by next August means we will cover the Theranos trial in person. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so other listeners can find it. If you don't like the podcast, please keep that fact to yourself. My guest has been Dr. Marcia Chatelain, and she is on Twitter at Dr. M. Chatelain, Chatelain. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.